or, you know, kind of like shoot ourselves in the own foot. But it means that there is always going to be complicated realities happening within those conceptualizations. There is going to be tension. There might even be conflict. And to some extent, I'm not going to expand upon this particular point. I feel like I haven't stewed long enough on it, but I think to some extent, our current conceptualization of is maybe actually quite fraught, and it can be, and it should be perhaps open to lots of reworking in order to more accurately and maybe in a slightly more decolonial way embrace the varied experiences of people from the continent, which is also, if you did not know already, is a colonial construct. So why am I bringing up all of this in an episode that is meant to scrutinize these questionable Wajian meetups? You'll find out after this music break. Let's listen now to some iconic Korean hip-hop. This next track is by somebody I think every person who loves Asian music should know. It's by Yoon Mi-rae, who is, I don't know if I can call her pioneering, mostly because I'm not too familiar with like the timeline, but she is considered an iconic figure of Korean hip hop. This is called Thin Lines by her, featuring her husband, Tiger JK, and I hope you enjoy it.
This is Bird Note, I'm Marcus Rostin, and while working for the New York State Department of Environmental Conservation, I assisted in a study into the behaviors of one of my favorite birds, the American woodcock. Woodcocks look like a shorebird that got lost in the woods. Their brown and black speckles camouflage them perfectly until they sing, which sounds less like singing and more like yelling the word "peent" over and over. We spent many nights waiting for the sun to set and the peenting to begin. We caught and equipped a female with a band and a GPS backpack to track her live as she migrated. We observed this bird flying over 600 miles south from Buffalo to spend the winter in North Carolina. One night, she flew nearly 400 miles without stopping. Picturing that bird on winter vacation on the coast reminded me how birds connect us all. From Iroquois National Wildlife Refuge in western New York to the Croatan National Forest in North Carolina, and all the stopover habitats in between, we need to prioritize protecting our grasslands and young growth forests so the woodcock's powerful peents can be heard long into the future. This week is Blackbirders Week. To learn how to participate, follow the hashtag Blackbirders Week on social media and visit birdnote.org.
Actually, last week was Blackbirders Week. I didn't have an opportunity to play that PSA. But honestly, if you are black and if you are a birder, every day could be Blackbirders Week. Happy Blackbirders Week. Happy belated Blackbirders Week. I'm Leslie, and this is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I've talked a lot about, like, the complexities of quote-unquote Asia and quote-unquote Asian identity, because fundamentally, all of this exists in a colonial reality, right? And in the ways that colonial Europe drew up the map and decided that this large mass of land was going to be called Asia. And then there's just an incredible amount of diversity. I don't know if I can say that word. I can use that word, but there's like lots of different cultures and people in Asia, as there are in, you know, in like other places of the globe. But using those geographical lines to define Asianness has its good things and also has its bad things. You know, it's very fraught in that way. But Asian identity, let's talk about this. Again, myself, I am not mixed race Asian. There's only so much that I can say that a lot of other people who are mixed race Asians have already talked about. I want to make very clear here, though, when I am scrutinizing the concept of these Asian meetups, it's not to dismiss the feelings of alienation and not belonging that a lot of white Asian people feel when it comes down to their heritage and connecting with their culture. Rather, I think my role in this conversation is to make the possible suggestion, who knows, that when you are not a fully white person, you are just simply not a fully white person. Why center whiteness in your exploration of your identity then? And again, when I say that, it is not meant to dismiss the feelings that you experience when you feel too alienated from your white side because you are too non-white. It's to point out rather that that comes from a place of exclusion and racism that actually lots of other Asian people experience. For example, consider transracial adoptees, kids who are Asian but they were adopted into white families and grew up in predominantly white communities, or even third culture kids, second generation kids who were raised in communities that are not predominantly populated by people of their heritage. They're not being raised in the country of where their parents are from. And they too have this kind of dual identity that they have to carry around with them. In all of these experiences, if you're a transracial adoptee, if you're a third culture kid, a second generation, third generation kid, etc., you are also experiencing racism at the hands of white supremacist culture. When it comes down to the experiences of those who are mixed Asian, but who are not mixed with white, you know, they're Black Asian, they are Indigenous and Asian, they are Asian from one side of the continent and the other side of the continent, you know, I will leave their critiques of Asianness to discuss, because they should be leading those specific conversations about what it is like to be racialized on both sides. The question that I will always raise with regards to those fraught experiences of Asian people not feeling appreciated enough is, why still try to align yourself with whiteness, and why still try to align yourself with white supremacy when in the eyes of white supremacy, you fundamentally having just a little inkling of something different in your phenotype automatically makes you not white. But this is what I want to raise to you. Whether or not you are mixed race Asian, whether or not you are fully Asian or whatever, we need to stop having this freaking conversation every single year, because we know what the solution is in order to actually uplift Asian people. And that is to decenter whiteness and to be in solidarity with other non-white people. It is to decolonize our ways of thinking and approaching the world and understanding our identities from a decolonial lens, from an anti-colonial lens. And that has always been the answer to how we uplift each other. That has always been the answer to how Asian people can find liberation. The call is coming within the house, if I'm going to be very honest with you. And this is something that, you know, I think appropriately I can feel very ashamed about. And I feel that many people who are also Asian can feel very ashamed about. A lot of the times, our own internalized racism and coloniality makes us want to center whiteness and makes us desire a proximity to whiteness and want us to be valid to whiteness. And this exists in various ways. One of the core tenets, of course, being colorism and things that have to do with your phenotype and your features. Prioritizing and valorizing white beauty standards. Sometimes, you know, you also have, like, a family member who, like, for whatever reason, only ever wants to date white people. That's a problem. And slightly related, but also unrelated to that, is just the way that people of our cultures value whiteness. I know a lot of people who... I would like to say that they're of the older generation, but that's not always true. I know of a lot of Asian folks who really want their relatives to have children with white people because they themselves fetishize the appearance of Asian people. That's not to say that, okay, if you are a Wajin, that is not to say like that you know, the love that your parents have might not be real or something like that. Hey, you are their child. I'm sure you have your own complicated relationship with your parents. But it is to point out that oftentimes in Asian families, in Asian culture, there are people who center whiteness in those specific ways. The call, again, is coming from inside the house. We reject our own cultures, our own people, for whiteness. And for what? Right? The antithesis of this is to not simply to reject whiteness and white supremacy. It is not simply to resist against it by saying like, oh, whatever, white people. White people and whatever. It's not to do that. Rather, to push towards liberation, we must not only reject whiteness, but more importantly, we have to love non-whiteness in all of its forms, including non-Asian racialized people. I think that's the harder thing for a lot of Asian folks to do, because we also have a family member who hates white people and who hates white shenanigans. They do not want to be living in North America surrounded by the nonsense of white supremacy. But they also might not like racialized people. They might not like themselves, they might not like their own people, and they might not like other racialized folks. Our call to action is to love all racialized people who are not white. If this is a concept that is new to you, trust and believe that there is work that has been done for decades already by Asian American political groups and organizers who organized alongside other politically radical racialized communities, such as Red Power, such as the Black Panthers. This is not new. In fact, this call to love all non-white racialized people, again, is something that people keep saying over and over again, right? We must be able to build bridges of solidarity with other racialized people, with indigenous communities, in order for us to actually experience liberation. Because I'm going to say it again and again, it does not matter your proximity to whiteness. You could be mixed race, you could be light-skinned Asian, you could, you know, speak without much of an accent. English could be your very first language. Maybe you were raised by white parents. Maybe you were raised in a community of basically only white people. It does not matter your proximity to whiteness. Within white supremacy, you will always not be white. You will never be good enough for white people. Your proximity to whiteness is never going to liberate you from the confines of racism. It's going to make it worse for you instead. So that is a number one thing that if you've not already started, you got to start doing. You know, just it's slowly. You can do it slowly. You know, you don't have to go all in. You can go all in if you want, but we are all works in progress. We are going to fight for the liberation of our people. We have to do so in solidarity with all other non-white people. I think one of the other things that we can also do as Asian folks to, I don't know, like, be more thoughtful about being Asian. I think we have to do this by undoing our own colonial mindsets. And one way to do that is to study the histories and cultures of Asia all over the continent. As I mentioned several times already, Asia is a colonial concept, right? It is a colonial construct, and it is flattened to be thought of homogenous by country. But within each country itself, there are very complex histories of migration, of colonization, conflict, and imperialism that make up the countries of our roots. And more importantly, they make up our cultures. I can use China as an example. So China is obviously a very big country when you look at it in the map. And to some extent, one might think that, hey, isn't actually a part of China supposed to be considered Central Asia? And isn't a part of China maybe supposed to be considered Southeast Asia, etc., etc.? We can't always have those geopolitical discussions. But one thing that we can recognize is the vast diversity of that country. If you, like me, are Chinese and you want to decolonize your understanding of Asianness, and even maybe to some extent your identity as a Chinese person, perhaps one of the things that you would want to do is to understand more of the history of the country, because geopolitics, but also because when you learn about the history of where your people come from, you have your own narrative and your own understanding of who you are. It's not going to be easy. It's not going to be always super simple to understand. It might also make you feel quite uncomfortable at times when you have to confront the histories of conflict and war, the forces that drove people to migrate, when you have to confront the realities maybe of imperialism and colonialism. But you get a better sense of who you are as a person, and you also develop a stronger sense of humanity towards people who are not you. And you can apply that to various other communities of people who are in a similar kind of struggle as you. Effectively, what I'm saying is that not only do we have to love and be in solidarity with all types of other non-white people, but we also have to decolonize our own identities and understandings of Asia and Asianness in order to have a foundation that allows us to scrutinize white supremacy and its concepts of racialization that, you know, continue to oppress us every day, literally, no matter where you live in the world. Anyways, that's it. That's the end of today's episode of Typically Tuesdays. It's a long one. It's a big one. It's a complicated one. But, yeah. when are we not doing this? Can we be real? When are we not? Hey, if you are Weijin and I upset you today, I am very sorry. I cannot speak to your specific experience of being mixed race and being white and Asian, but I can say, as an Asian person with a little bit of proximity to whiteness because of my light skin and because I speak English fluently, amongst maybe a number of other things, whenever I've tried to validate myself against the standards of white supremacy, it has just hurt me more. It took me away from my values to live in a world where everybody can be free, including myself, but importantly, other people. And I found that it felt more fulfilling and felt more true to myself to not define myself against whiteness and to find parallels and solidarity with other racialized people who too were going through some other similar form of discrimination that I was up against. You know, the invitation to decolonize and to build bridges of solidarity are there. Join us. You'll probably love it. And to all of my other Asian people who are somewhat, maybe potentially fraughtly considered Asian, maybe not, I don't know. Wow. Life is weird, isn't it? Let me know your thoughts, I guess. Text me, 778-782-2573. And I will see your message, or you can send me an email, typicallytuesdays@gmail.com, and I would love to know your thoughts. For now, we're going to close off the show with one final track. Thank you so much for tuning in to Typically Tuesdays today on CJSF 90.1 FM. Oh, one more thing. Listen to more great CJSF programming. You should check out Analog Archives, which airs every Thursday from 6 to 7. With your host Danny. He goes through the physical archives of the music library here at CJSF, and it's always a time. It's always very interesting. Check it out Thursdays every week from 6 to 7 here on 90.1 FM. One final track for you today. This is by one of the, I believe, original OPM groups. OPM refers to original Filipino music. It's like a pop music, originally like kind of like a pop music movement from the 1970s. Here's Cinderella. With T.L. Akosayo. I've been Leslie on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'll talk to you again very soon.